That was Art Farmer with The Touch of Your Lips and Benny Golson there on the sax. That was hand-selected by our guest this evening on Improvisations, Bill Rukeyser. Bill, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Todd.
Now, you're currently the chairman of the university health system, correct?
That is correct.
And then reading your Wikipedia entry, which is very fascinating and has a lot of interesting twists and turns in it. We'll start with the part where you came to Knoxville. Why here? Why did you end up here after being at Money Magazine and other places?
I was offered a job that I couldn't refuse by Chris Whittle at Whittle Communications to be the editor-in-chief. And my family and I thought that the job offer was so good that we'd tough it out in Knoxville for 3 or 4 years because it was such a good place to get a job. And here we are 30 years later. And it's because we want to be here.
Did you feel that way right off, or did that come like 4 or 5 years into it?
It was pretty immediate. I remember when I was being recruited, I came down here one time, and one of the other editors took me to lunch at some luncheonette. I think it may have been Lines. Of course, at the time, I didn't know what it was, but it was an ordinary plain luncheonette. And the waitress was so nice and so concerned that I should be enjoying my sandwich that eventually, as a New Yorker, I had to look up and make sure she wasn't putting me on or preparing to assault me. Turned out she was just nice.
She didn't assault you then?
No.
And you stayed.
And in the course of the 7 or so years that I was at Whittle, we recruited hundreds of people from around the country, mostly somewhat reluctantly, not just because of Knoxville. People don't like to move anywhere, but Knoxville wasn't a slam dunk the first time you mentioned it. We found that anybody who came with a family, almost 100%, loved it, wanted to stay. After Whittle folded, a tremendous number of the people we recruited reluctantly ended up staying here. Some of them are still around. Single people were chancier, even though I did try to explain to them that it was possible to mate with these Tennesseans who didn't work for Whittle Communications.
Oh, I have a lot of friends that came out of that initial several years of crop. A lot of the single people did move on, but it was such a great infusion to Knoxville, too. You know, that's the other side of it.
Yes, but Knoxville helped.
And so does Art Farmer. That music was just beautiful. The Benny Golson solo was the reason you chose that, right?
Well, I chose it also for the Art Farmer. It's a beautiful track, I think, and it sort of exemplifies the kind of jazz that I like best, melodic and swinging.
Did you grow up listening to jazz? Is this something that your parents were into and you were by definition also, or did you find it on your own?
It wasn't my parents or my brothers, although they had an interest in pop music, as we all did. Most of us still enjoy the occasional Sinatra song. When I was about 12 or 13, my best friend in junior high school, somebody named Jimmy Watson, son of a doctor, happened to be just a almost professional-level reed player at a very early age, and his chosen type was jazz, and he got me interested. And when I was about 14, that must have all happened a little bit earlier, having failed at guitar lessons, I decided that what I really wanted to do was play the drums, and at that time there was a drum, I was living in the near inner suburb of New York. And in New York City at that time, there was a drum school run by Gene Krupa and Cozy Cole. I matriculated there on Saturday mornings and became a kind of mid-level dance band drummer in my high school years. But jazz was our passion, Jimmy and mine. We were too young to drink, but we sneaked in anyway. At the time, we just thought the music was great. We didn't realize that in retrospect, it would look like one of the greatest times in history to be around Manhattan. But while I'm on the subject of Jimmy, who I may soon see again after many decades, because I'm going to attend a high school reunion where I think he's going to be. Jimmy didn't stay in music. If I had had his musical talent, I'd be a professional musician. Maybe worked out just as well that I didn't have the ability to do that, but listening to it has remained a big priority in my life.
And when you were in New York during that incredible period of jazz music, how often, because you're so young, were you able to get into all the clubs, or where did it didn't seem like the rules were holding you completely back from based on your previous statements, but did you go see a lot of?
I did, and in those days, the drinking age in New York was only 18, but still, that was somewhat of an obstacle. We did a little sneaking in, but there were some ways around it. A couple of things I remember. The town where I lived, just outside New York City, was New Rochelle, which is on Long Island Sound in Westchester. At New Rochelle was a place called the Glen Island Casino, former big band venue. And on Sunday afternoons, I guess not every Sunday afternoon, but I remember certain Sunday afternoons, they had performances of whoever was playing there without alcohol, so that underage people could just go legitimately. And I attended a number of those, and I very much remember both Count Basie's band and Dizzy Gillespie's band. It's where I first heard Dizzy do his famous thing about, "Now I'd like to introduce the band. Jimmy, this is Melba. Melba, that's Frank." he was a great musician, obviously, unparalleled trumpet player in my view. But he also understood that it's entertainment too.
What about getting into Manhattan? Were you able to go into the Village and places like that?
And I'm a little hazy at this stage of my life as to exactly whether this was high school or college. I spent a lot of time in jazz clubs in New York. The big ones in Midtown were the original Birdland. There was Basin Street East, which was more upscale. It was more like a sort of traditional nightclub, 20th century nightclub. That's where you had to go to hear Louis Armstrong or Ella Fitzgerald, a few other people like that. I remember it being frequently, it was multiple times anyway. Downtown, the two places that we spent most time, the Village Vanguard was always there, and we did go there. There was the Five spot, and then there were the one that we frequented most often was the Half Note over at Hudson and Spring, where I recall hearing, among others, Mose Allison, Stan Getz. The attraction, aside from the music, was it was really cheap. The food, as was generally true of jazz clubs in those days, was horrible. That's been a big change. Actually, you can now get a reasonable thing to eat in a jazz club. The main meal was meatballs, spaghetti and meatballs, and pitchers of beer, which at the time I thought was okay.
Yeah, but everything you needed.
Yeah, and in all those places, you could hang out with the musicians. Thanks to my friend Jimmy's doctor father, he and I attended the second Newport Jazz Festival in 1955 when it was still in Newport. And it was in a park, and it was very informal. You could wander around behind the stage and interact with musicians. I remember talking to the trumpet player Ruby Braff and to my idol at the time, Jerry Mulligan.
And the next cut we have lined up is Jerry Mulligan with Thelonious Monk. This is I Mean You from Mulligan Meets Monk. Jerry Mulligan and Thelonious Monk, I Mean You, and our guest is Bill Rukeyser here on Improvisations. Bill is choosing all the tunes in this set, and I'm enjoying them as well. Are you more of a Mulligan than a Monk fan, or do you like them both
no,
together?
No, both. I'm not sure I ever heard Monk play in a club. I think I heard him at Town Hall once. As you're probably aware, in those days, you had to have a cabaret permit to work in New York, and if you had any kind of a drug offense, and in his case, it was a questionable marijuana bust, although I don't think it was questionable that he might have used some marijuana once or twice. And so he wasn't allowed to play for a lot of his career. It was impossible for him to make a living in New York. In the earlier part of my getting to know jazz when I was a young teenager, I think that, like a lot of us at the time, we didn't know what to make of Monk. It was so different. It just wasn't clear what was going on. But once you get it, it became a big enthusiasm. And of course, now when you hear Thelonious play, it just sounds like jazz. I mean, our ears have become attuned to it. They used to say, you know, you're playing wrong notes, and his answer was, the piano has no wrong notes. Jerry Mulligan, as I've indicated, was an early enthusiasm, right from the time he was running his pianoless quartet with Chet Baker on the West Coast. The pianoless quartet was a very interesting experiment, and I think what he had in mind was, by not having the piano to give chords and fills, it forced the other horn player or players to keep busy during somebody else's solo. And in the, if you listen to Mulligan through the years with the things he did with Zoot Sims and others, it's as complicated counterpoint as exists in jazz, as far as I can remember.
Yeah, my relationship with Monk goes back to my teen years when I just read a lot of people, you know, would say like, oh, you know, I love Monk. You know, even my rock musician idols, you know, Thelonious Monk records are pretty great, and I would go out and buy them. And in those days, I only had enough for a few records, so I had to make it count. So when I buy a Monk record, I'd say, well, I don't get it, but I'm going to listen to it until I do. And it's weird because it did. It didn't sound. I mean, there's something intriguing about the syncopation and the clusters and things, but I didn't get the beauty and the swing of it until I'd listened to it, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of times.
I would say it's possible that he has become my absolute favorite jazz musician. If I had to just go to a desert island and take one thing, I might take a Monk record.
But I'd say a good runner-up would be Ella Fitzgerald, and that's your next selection. Tell me about your relationship with Ella Fitzgerald, and I probably need to rephrase that question.
I had the joy of attending many Ella Fitzgerald concerts in New York at Basin Street East. I worked in Europe for several years in the beginning of my journalistic career, and I remember hearing her on the Riviera at the Captain Pitenti, one of those festivals. She was she came across as a lovely person as well as a fantastic singer. And one of the things that she had in common with Louis Armstrong was handkerchiefs. Armstrong, of course, was always mopping his brow with the handkerchief. Ella would sort of hold it against her ear, I think, to make sure that she was still in tune. Sometimes she would, as far as I could tell, she was always in tune, but sometimes you'd see her sort of leaning over with the handkerchief against her ear and listening to herself. She sang. She said thank you very much. She rarely had any extended stories to tell, but the music was great. And you may be aware that when the late pianist Hank Jones was in Knoxville, that one of the stories he told was for a while he was her main accompanist, and one night things were going badly, and after her first chorus, Ella came back to the piano and she said, if it's going to be like this, I think I may quit the business. And he said, I'm going to go down in history as the man who made Ella Fitzgerald quit singing. It didn't happen.
Fortunately. And with her collection of recordings is immense and wonderful. And like Billie Holiday, that there's a charm to the early stuff and there's a different kind of charm to the late stuff. You chose Little White Lies from Ella Swings Lightly. Why that particular cut?
It's the album Ella Swings Lightly, which is, I think, possibly with Marty Page. It sounds like a Marty Page dectet, has always been a great favorite of mine because it meets my two main criteria. It's melodic and it swings, and it's just Ella at her absolute mid-career best.
The moon was all aglow, and heaven was in your eyes. The night that you told me those little white lies, the stars all seemed to know that you didn't mean all those sighs. The night that you told me those little white lies, I tried but there's no forgetting when evening appears. I sigh, but there's no regretting in spite of my tears. The devil was in your heart, but heaven was in your eyes. The night that you told me the whole was little white lies. I try, but there's no forgetting when evening appears. I sigh, but there's no regretting in spite of my tears. Who wouldn't believe those lips? Who ever could doubt those eyes? That you told me those little white lies. Those little white, tiny white, little white lies.
You can't beat that vocal. Ella Fitzgerald with Little White Lies. This is Improvisations. I'm Todd Steed. We're talking with Bill Rukeyser, who's picking out tunes for us. We had some Monk earlier, some Art Farmer, and Benny Golson. That was Ella Fitzgerald. So we'll come back in just a moment and see Bill's final selection for us to listen to this evening, and I think you will love it. This is your jazz radio station, 91.9 FM, WUOT in HD1 Knoxville. And by the way, if you have one of those smart speakers, that's what they call them, smart speakers, you can just say, play WUOT, and it will do it. It should. If they don't, let me know, and we'll come over and fix it. All right, we'll be right back with more jazz music. You're listening to Improvisations. I'm talking with Bill Rukeyser. We've been enjoying some Ella Fitzgerald. That recording just sounds so luscious. You know, and it was recorded in the 50s, but really, it's amazing how good the sound quality was on that material.
It's one of the great gifts that you can listen to this now, almost 60-year-old music, and it's as if it were just happening. At the time, old music was a big problem because recording techniques really only got good around the 50s, late 40s, 50s. When I think back on it, Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives and Hot Sevens in the mid-20s were really only 30 years old when I was first getting interested in jazz, but it sounded like it came from the Paleolithic period. I mean, it was all these horrible old recordings. I mean, some of the re-releases since then have been cleaned up and refined, but music from the 20s and even the 30s really sounded old-fashioned, not just from stylistically, but technically, whereas now, that's just not true, and it's great. It means people like Ella are alive in an important sense.
Your final cut that you've chosen is from the Knoxville Jazz Orchestra. It's Russian Dance, and it's on their Christmas recording. You've been involved, of course, with the Knoxville Jazz Orchestra, and another one of those things that make living in Knoxville something that is very nice. You know, another reason to stay in Knoxville, I like to say, because the Knoxville Jazz Orchestra and everything that they've done and all the incredible people they've brought in. What would you like to say about them?
Well, let me back up a little bit and say that when I first came to Knoxville 30 years ago, I was looking forward to the job and to learning a new place and meeting new people, but I thought that probably one of the things I was giving up by leaving the New York area was a lively jazz scene. And I was almost immediately disabused of that when I went down to Lucille's and places like that, where there were just, as I said at the time to some of my friends from New York, if you walked into the Blue Note in Greenwich Village and heard whatever group I had heard at Lucille's, I think I know probably who it was, if you walked into the Blue Note and heard them, you wouldn't think something's wrong here. This was world level jazz. I think probably I was listening to the great Billy Scarlett and I think probably the young Vance Thompson and some of the other people that were very much involved with the Knoxville Jazz Orchestra. I first heard the KJO in 2000. They were appearing at the Bijou, raising money for their first ever trip to Europe, and I did just sort of saw there was a jazz orchestra, so I'm going to go and listen. And first of all, I thought they were great. And I also then started thinking, and I thought, isn't it great that Knoxville has something like this? And I thought, well, they probably won't stick together for long unless they get organized. And so I volunteered my services to Vance Thompson, the founder and leader, and got involved. And it's been one of the most satisfying associations of my life. The Knoxville Jazz Orchestra is now one of the premier jazz orchestras of the country, and it's a pleasure to be associated with them. This particular track is an arrangement by Vance Thompson of a traditional song.
And even though this is off their Christmas record, it sounds good to me any time, night or day, any time of the year.
It's Christmas 365, 24/7 when this is played.
That's right. So here it is, the Knoxville Jazz Orchestra with Russian Dance, and I believe this one features Gregory Tardy, at least Gregory Tardy.
Thank you.
The Knoxville Jazz Orchestra with Russian Dance from their Christmas album. That and all of our songs this evening have been chosen by Bill Rukeyser, who's been our guest. And Bill, it was really fun to have you down just to, you know, take away some of my programming homework from me.
Feelings mutual. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So what do you got planned? Do you have any shows coming up you want to see, or any records you're excited about hearing, or?
Well, I'm very excited about the KJO's next concert, which is within a very short time from now. I'm sure I should know the date, but with our repeat guest Stefan Harris, the great vibraphonist.
And I'll probably see you there.
I hope so.
All right,
I'll look for you.
All right, Bill. Thanks a lot. Next up on Improvisations, we'll hear from a member of the Knoxville Jazz Orchestra, Will Boyd. He has a new record out. It's called Live at the Red Piano Lounge. This is the closing track featuring Kelly Jolly of the Jazz Jam fame, Mama Don't Allow.